Hey everyone, this is Madison Miller, host of the Veteran Narrative Podcast, and I am so excited to have you here with me today for our very first episode. Before we get started, I just wanted to take a minute to give a few thank yous. Thank you to you, listeners, for tuning in and for supporting this project from the start. And thank you to our very first podcast guest, Tom Dial. Tom Dial is an Army veteran from Coshocton, Ohio. As you'll learn, he is an advocate for veterans within his local community, and I am so excited to share his story with you. So with all of that being said, let's get started. Hello and welcome to the Veteran Narrative Podcast. My name is Madison and I am so excited that you're here listening with me today. The sole purpose of this podcast is to create a really empowering environment and community for United States military veterans to be able to come on and share their testimonies. Now let's dive right in.
Tom, it is so good to have you here. Thank you so much for being my first ever podcast guest. This is so exciting. But I know you had sent me your testimony a little bit, but for anybody listening, do you want to take a second to introduce yourself?
I'm Tom Dial from Coshocton, Ohio. Did 20 years in the Army. I'm presently in the Honor Guard and Color Guard, and I'm ready to answer questions.
So let's kind of dive in a little bit. Your Army career really started, I know you said, at the age of six.
Thereabouts. My grandfather was an engineer in the Army. My great-grandfather was a bugler in a machine gun battalion in the Army in World War I. My grandfather was World War II. My grandfather was World War I. And just growing up hearing their stories, what little they divulged, just got me knowing that I was going to join the Army when I got old enough.
So they weren't ones to really talk about it?
Not much, because they were both in actual war. Mm-hmm. And they told me some stuff, but they didn't get down in the dirty.
So you've always had your eyes set on Army. There wasn't any other branch you wanted to go into. It was just, you knew from day one it was going to be the Army.
I didn't want to get brainwashed by the Marines. I didn't want to get stuck out in the ocean for 6 to 8 months at a time in the Navy. And I had glasses, so I knew I couldn't fly.
Well, I mean, that narrows it down. Age of six is so young to just absolutely know that you were going to be a man in the Army. So I know you had said you had then gone into the Boy Scouts. What mm-hmm. kind of drew you to that moment?
That was the closest thing I'd get to the Army. Mm-hmm. And I've always lived up in the outdoors in the country. So I joined the Boy Scouts as soon as I could. Went all the way up through the ranks, became an Eagle Scout. It was funny because once I got in basic training, the drill instructors thought I was prior service. Because I went in one rank higher than everybody else. And I knew navigation. I knew outdoor stuff. I knew a lot of stuff that nobody else knew. And when I told them, no, I wasn't prior service. I was just an Eagle Scout. They were shocked.
I never really thought about the transferable skills from Boy Scouts into the military. I think that's really cool to see that they assume that you just had prior service just mm-hmm. off of what you had learned. When you were an Eagle Scout, I assume you're probably high school rank at that point, right?
Right.
When you were in high school, I saw that you had done the delayed entry program. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
When I was still 17, December of 1973, I went. Parents had to sign off for me and everything. I went delayed entry program. And 6 months later, I went active duty. 3 weeks after I graduated in June, I was active duty.
Did you know you were going to be active duty once you signed the papers and such?
Oh, yeah. So once I signed the papers and delayed entry, I couldn't back out without getting in trouble.
Were your parents, were they, like, on board with this plan? I assume you're probably like, yep, I'm going Army, I'm doing this.
They knew from me being from 6 years on, they knew I was going to go in the Army. So they had no qualms about it.
Fair enough. So once you were sent off, you said 3 weeks after high school, mm-hmm. you were sent to Fort Ord, California for mm-hmm. BASIC. Right. So tell me about BASIC.
Well, we were part of an experiment program where they sent kids from the East Coast to the West Coast and kids from the West Coast to the East Coast to see if it cut down on AWOLs. And it didn't. We still had an AWOL. And I don't know where he ended up at, but he disappeared. And basic training, we just went in there. We learned our basic stuff to be a soldier, riflemanship, marksmanship, a little bit of bayoneting skills back then. We didn't have too much of that. Mm-hmm. Throwing hand grenades, marching, all the stuff you need to know to become a soldier.
You said something about AWOL. So was that an issue with people enlisting of, like, just going AWOL? Will you kind of explain what that means for anyone who might not know?
AWOL is absent without official leave, which means that you get in there, and it happens all the way through your career. Mm-hmm. There can be people that's submitting in there for 15 years. They just disappear. Hmm. And especially basic training, you get these young guys in there, and they get a drill sergeant in their face, whatever the case may be. They just call them all kinds of names. mm-hmm. and they can't handle it.
Yeah. Did you think that you had yourself mentally prepared with what you thought your expectations were in basic? What did you do to prepare yourself when you went in?
Nobody's prepared for them drill sergeants.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Once they get in your face, you're just going, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, drill sergeant.
Goodness.
And you do what they're told mm-hmm. to do, and you do the best you can, and you mm-hmm. stay out of their bad list.
Mm-hmm. Once you're out of basic and you go on to the advanced training, mm-hmm. did you have an idea in mind of which specific job or career that you wanted to take
up? Oh, the day I enlisted, I knew what I was going to be doing.
Oh, okay.
When I first enlisted, I wanted to go infantry. Mm-hmm. And recruiter said they were full of infantry, wow. which I thought was hard to believe. I said, what else do you have in a combat arms field? I didn't want to be no desk jockey. I didn't want nothing like that. I want to be out in the field. I said, we got tanks. We got artillery. I said, okay, what's artillery do? I said, they go out, they set up in one position, and they fire. Hmm. What's tanks do? They're constantly moving. I said, tanks. I never look back.
I find it really intriguing to think that the infantry was full.
Yeah, I can't believe that either, but that's what he told me at the time.
Do you have any thoughts as to, like, why he would have said that or why the infantry would have been full?
Because they needed other people and other job titles.
Hmm, interesting. And
it might have been full because back then they were taking people, anybody, if you was about to go to jail, you had a choice going to jail or going in the military. So,
interesting.
And that's where they threw them.
Wow, I did not know that. So you needed a job right away that was going to keep you moving, keep you engaged, and right. you wanted to be out there actively doing something in the field.
Yeah.
I know that there's a lot of, like, behind-the-scenes jobs that were still engaging on the field, but did you need something that was more like combat, or did you want something that was...
Keep me busy. You know, it didn't have to be, you know, mm-hmm. out-and-out combat. I just wanted something to keep me busy, something that was going to keep me interested. Mm-hmm. And tanks was just something that sounded interesting.
Yeah, I'd say. Mm-hmm. I'd say working on a tank would be really interesting. When you went into it, you said you were an Army crewman. Can you tell me a little bit about what that entailed? How did you get into that actual position?
Well, when you first get on tanks, you're a driver. You learn everything. In AIT, you learn how to be a driver and how to be a loader. And then as you get into your first duty station, you're always a driver first. Mm-hmm. That's the lowest rank. As you move from there, you go up to become a loader. And then from loader to gunner, then gunner to tank commander.
Hmm.
And that's the progression up to the tanks.
So they really make you learn everything about it yeah. during your time.
Yeah.
Did you have, like, a favorite position that you liked to be in the tank?
I loved a gunner. Fire that main gun, fire the machine guns.
Mm-hmm. You know. Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like to be in the actual, let's say the first one, for example, like... Are these tanks large? Like, give me an idea of kind of what these...
64 tons.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a little heavy.
And they're tall, mm-hmm. squat, well, not squat, wide vehicles, beautiful vehicles. Mm-hmm. I loved it until I got on the M1. And they were just awesome vehicles.
How many people had fit inside of them?
Four. You've got the driver, who's in his own little compartment down under, and then you got the loader, the gunner, and the tank commander.
Interesting.
And the same thing with the M1s.
I know you had said that you liked the M60 until you were in the Abrams. So was there anything that led to that switch there? Or did you, like, become more advanced and they put you there? Or is it just kind of whatever's available?
We didn't get the the M1s came out because the M60s was getting obsolete.
Oh, okay.
And we needed something more powerful, more deadly mm-hmm. to go against Russia. At that time, we were mm-hmm. still preparing for Russia. Mm-hmm. We didn't get the M1s until we got to Saudi Arabia for Desert Storm. And the commercials you see on TV where the M1s would go airborne over to the top of this hill mm-hmm. and land and keep on going, I thought, nah. Because the old 60s, you do that, mm-hmm. and you're going to bust your torsion bars, which hold your wheels up.
Yeah.
And that's not a good problem to have. Mm-hmm. That's hard work. The M1s, I did it. We went airborne.
Goodness.
And we came down and we kept on going. Them were awesome machines.
That's crazy. So were you stateside when you had made that switch, or did you say you were in...
We were in Saudi. I was actually stationed in Germany, mm-hmm. but we were in Saudi Arabia.
When you were in Saudi, what year was this? When you had the M1, you took the M1 airborne. Give me, like, a timeline of where we're at.
Well, we were landed in Saudi, in my unit, mm-hmm. January 1st of 1991.
But... Was that your first time abroad? I feel like I'm missing a piece in the middle.
That was my third. I was Fort Knox, Kentucky, mm-hmm. Germany, mm-hmm. Erlangen, Germany, not Erlangen, Kirschgorn, Germany, mm-hmm. also called The Rock. Back to Fort Bliss, Texas. First time and only time I was ever in a cav unit. Back to Germany, Friedberg at that time. Mm-hmm. Back to Fort Polk, Louisiana, Springfield, Ohio for recruiting duty. Mm-hmm. Back to Fort Polk, Louisiana. Back to Germany, Erlangen. Mm-hmm. And then from Erlangen, we went to Desert Storm.
That's a lot of moving around.
Yeah.
Did you have a absolute favorite place that you had gone to between that time before you were sent to Desert Storm?
Germany.
Germany?
I love Germany.
What was your favorite part about Germany?
The culture, the food, the festivals, everything. Mm-hmm. It's just a beautiful place. They got houses over there older than the United States. And they've got a lot of the buildings still has potholes in it from World War II. Wow. Where the bullets mm-hmm. was hitting it. And just the ancient castles, everything like that. Mm-hmm. And to get from here in Kishatin to another state would be the same time period as getting from central Germany to another country. Because everything, Belgium, mm-hmm. France, Czechoslovakia, Norway, mm-hmm. everything is so close around there. It's like driving to another state. Mm-hmm. So it's great.
What was your job, or I guess your mission while you were in Germany? And that could be any of the times that you were there and you were back and forth.
Well, up until Desert Storm, up until 89, when the wall came down, our basic primary duty was guarding Germany from Russian invasion. Mm-hmm. And we'd go on alerts, and we'd go up to Folder Gap. Mm-hmm. And we'd sit there and for a little while. At the most we ever sat there was 2 weeks. And then we'd go back to our duty station and sit there and wait for the next time we got called on alert.
So how often did the alerts come?
Not very often. Maybe once or twice a year. Mm-hmm. Just keep us on our toes. Mm-hmm. That's not like Russia ever did anything to provoke it. We just did it to keep ourselves on ready.
Mm-hmm. So in between alerts, did you just have free rein to kind of explore or really do whatever? Did they have things to keep up your training while you were there? Like, were you constantly occupied by the military or were you on free rein?
During the weekdays, we were always in a motor pool doing maintenance and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we'd go to a place called Grafenwehr. We'd do our major gunnery. Mm-hmm. We'd be down there for a month. We had a place called Hohenfels. We went and did maneuver training. And we had a training area called Wildflicken. Wildflicken is not a place you want to go to. Mm-hmm. It is cold in the wintertime. Freezing. And that was mainly maneuvering. Mm-hmm. So we always had some place to go to at least twice a year to do our training, maneuver training. Gotcha. And firing gun training.
When you had found out that you were going to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, mm-hmm. were you in Germany at the time for that?
Yes. I was at my third duty mm-hmm. station. We just finished a major inspection. We were sitting around waiting for the results of the inspection when the president came across the TV naming the units that was going to go, and boom, our unit was mentioned.
Were you ready for that moment, or is that something that you guys were expecting?
No, we were not. We were always ready for it because we're trained to be ready for it. We were not expecting it because we figured since we're in Germany, they're going to send other units down there if necessary. And we knew what was going on, but we weren't expecting to be moved out. Mm-hmm. So when they called our name, some of us were in awe. Some of us were happy. Some of us were frightened. Everybody had different attitudes. Mm-hmm. And what was funny was our commanders didn't even know about it. When they came out of the inspection, we says, President just told us we're going to move to Saudi Arabia. So our company commander went back to battalion commander. Battalion commander went to brigade commander. They knew nothing about it. It was above their heads even. For the next 3 months, we were packing up, doing more training, everything mm-hmm. we can to get ready to move our tanks out. Mm-hmm. We got our M60A1 tanks. Shipped down to Saudi, probably about 15 people went with them. The rest of us flew down. Once we got our tanks down there, got them off the boats, we took them out the field and then traded them back in for M1s. And that's what we actually went to the war with, was the M1s. That's how it happened.
It blows my mind that the people overseeing all of you guys had absolutely no idea that you were being sent.
Yeah.
Were tensions just like at a max? Because I mean, I feel like even like 3 months... Like, that's a lot of time, I feel like, if mm-hmm. someone comes up, we're going to war, here's everyone getting deployed, but you have 3 months to prepare. Mm-hmm. Was that something that was typical for everyone, or was that just because you guys were in Germany with tanks?
I can't say for people here in the States, but that was mm-hmm. probably typical, because we're not a rapid deployment unit. We're not the special forces or anything like that, where gotcha. They're ready to go on a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. We've got 63 tons of tanks to get ready, plus ourselves, mm-hmm. wheels to write. Everything like that. Mm-hmm. We were kept busy during that 3 months.
And then how long were you there directly? I know you said I think you went from like Kuwait, fought through Iraq, and then ended up elsewhere. But tell me a little bit about your time once you guys had gotten there.
Once we got into Saudi Arabia, we got all of our tanks and everything ready. We moved out to forward areas, out in the desert a little bit. Set out there, did some more training, basically waiting to see what was going to happen. Everybody was hoping that Iraq was going to pull out of Kuwait. We left there, went to another area, sat there and waited. Then we moved closer to the border and sat there. And when they called us and told us that the air war was going to happen, we sat there and watched the bombers going across and lighting up the enemy out in the desert. And finally they called us and told us within a short time period, I think it was 48 hours, we're moving. And that's when the ground war started. And we crossed the berm and into Iraq and did our job.
I thought it was really interesting that when you had first gotten there, I know in one of the pieces that you had wrote, you had said that a few hours later we had found out that something that sounded like thunder was actually bombs. In the beginning, when you had thought it was just like that thunder and then kind of like putting two and two together, what was that feeling like actually hearing that the war had begun?
Apprehension. Not knowing what was going to come about. And like in one of my poems, I mentioned it's when is there going to be our time? And just sitting there and watching and listening and waiting.
I mean, it even gets me choked up because on even just the last paragraph of it of, so as we sit here listening into the night, we know that our time is near for us to join in the fight. Because I know earlier in some of the testimony and the written aspects you had given me was that there is mixed emotions because you were happy that after 16 years of serving that you'd be able to actually perform the job, but then the anticipation and the fear started to set in. I can't imagine just that back and forth emotion of that. When you had written these two poems and these excerpts, were you abroad, like deployed when you had written these there, or was this more of gotcha?
All the poems that I put in there, I wrote in the desert.
Is writing something that has been an outlet for you?
I've been writing poems since my English teacher back in junior high school got me writing. And it's just something I've enjoyed doing and I've done ever since then. I've got over 300 poems, I think.
That's amazing. I know everyone kind of has their thing, but I love the way that you were able to put it into words. Because I feel like, especially me being here and not ever having to serve, I feel like God's called me in different ways. But I always say, like, I will never understand truly what a veteran has gone through, but I always sit here and try, and I try to learn, and obviously, like, doing this podcast and the nonprofit to help others, but it makes it easier to try to understand when veterans share in the way that they feel comfortable and confident in, and just the way that you can do that with words, especially in your poem War, I just thought was amazing.
That's the one.
I mean, it truly, just the overall experience of how you said it here, of no words can explain, a picture portray, no movie can gain the feeling of one day of war. I think that's unreal because it's it's interesting. Because I always say, even like in history books, I can't tell you a time that I saw a desert storm. And, you know, it's heartbreaking. Granted, our textbook, Zach Shocked in High School, probably a little old. I wouldn't be shocked if our textbooks that we had were from the 80s. But even now, trying to find materials to cover things like this and like your experience. So having it in writing just for generations to come to be able to see that and try to grasp, I think is amazing. And while you were sitting there in the desert, like, I should write this down. Like, I should capture this moment.
That's the journal that I wrote. I was sharing it with one of our commanders on the 30th anniversary. He was doing his notes and I started doing mine every day that I had written down in my journal. And he came back, he says, he really appreciated my notes, my journals entries, because I covered the weather, what life was like on the tanks, how we fought each other, and everything like that, where it was down to the individuals, where his was battalion level and company level, and he didn't really get down nitty-gritty like that. And he, coming from he was lieutenant colonel by the time he retired, but back then he was a commander, company commander. To have him tell me how much he appreciated what I had written, that was awesome.
I bet. And that's what I thought was interesting too, because I love talking to veterans, because you can have two people who work the same job at the same time in the same battalion, but both of them will have completely different accounts. And even like books that I've read from veteran authors, the way that they describe it is completely different than someone else. With you and your experience in writing, I mean, I literally made a note of that. Like, you said at one point, it was 115 degree desert heat. You were able to recall it was 5:45 in the morning. It was these things. Like, when you're remembering these things, like, you add so many details that I don't see a lot. But for me, who I've never served, I mean, I'm able to paint that picture. I mean,
well, at nighttime, you know, when everything else is calmed down, and that's when I did my writing.
Is that something that has always just given you security, even like before being deployed or after? Is this just something that you've always done to kind of get thoughts on a paper? Or is it just something you've enjoyed?
My journal, that journal is the first time I ever did anything like that.
Really?
My poems, I've written poems about everything under the sun, but that's the first time I ever did a journal like that.
Well, you're a fantastic writer, and just having all of your experiences put down in the way that it is, it's really amazing.
I appreciate that.
I'm very thankful that you're able to really capture those moments, because I mean, I think it's so important for generations like mine and even those younger than me, when they're able to comprehend all of these things, to see this, you know, like, we can't let this be forgotten.
Right.
I know now, because was it after Desert Storm, how many years until you had retired once you were brought back and you had moved
on? We came back in, I believe it was May, end of May of 91, and I retired in June of 94.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I came back to the States December of 93.
Mm-hmm.
And I got back to the States, to Fort Knox, which is what I requested to retire out of, because that's closest to home. And the tank unit to Fort Knox, they were getting ready to go to California for training, and because I was so short, they didn't want me. So I deactivated my unit over in Germany. I was one of the last six people to leave that unit in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They sent me over to a medical unit because they were deactivating.
Mm-hmm.
So first time I ever had females in the same unit with me, and I had a female platoon sergeant in charge of me. That was a whole new experience. So I had to take them through the ropes on what to do to deactivate and all the paperwork they needed to do and that kind of good stuff. So that was an experience there.
Oh, I bet. It even kind of blows my mind a little bit, because I feel like there's a more prominent presence of women in the military now. But I guess when you had served, like when you were serving, that probably wasn't as much of
a thing. We did not have women in combat arms.
Really?
No.
And was that a requirement, or just women just didn't?
That was a requirement. They could not serve in combat arms.
Wow, that's crazy. Bouncing back, you were going through the deactivations. Was the second deactivation, was that already on your radar, or were you told that, like, you just had to deactivate your unit and then come back?
My first deactivation was my last unit in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the downsizing of all the units in Germany.
Gotcha.
That's why we had to deactivate.
Okay. When you came back and you had officially retired and you were able to start to transition into civilian life. Mm-hmm. How old were you at that time?
38.
So coming back and transferring everything that you've learned from the military, what was that transition like of then going into civilian life?
For me, it wasn't that hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't have blinders on for the military.
Mm-hmm.
I looked outside the world. I traveled. I did things civilians did also,
mm-hmm.
while still being a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that hard for me. I got out, had a hard time finding a job at first. The bank I dealt with for the last 20 years told me they would not give me a loan because I no longer had a job. So I took all my money. My mom and dad took all their money at that bank.
Mm-hmm.
And we transferred to another bank, and I got my house loan. Just being told that, yeah, you did spend 20 years serving your country. We're not going to help you out. Kind of slapped me in the face.
Yeah.
It wasn't long after that when I got into the Honor Guards and I started connecting with other veterans. And that's a big help right there.
Mm-hmm.
For any veteran to be able to connect with other veterans and talk about things. And some of these veterans in the Honor Guard, they've got such precise memories. Mm-hmm. They can name names from 30 years ago. Yeah, Joe Blow did this, Joe Blow did that. I can't even remember names of my people in my unit from 20 years ago. It's just a big help to be able to connect with other veterans.
They're the only other people who know exactly what you experienced and exactly what you went through.
Yeah.
I know you had said everything with the bank and having issues even getting loans, which blows my mind. I know you had put down that when you came back after your retirement that you ended up becoming a real estate agent to specialize in helping veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Was that like an easy decision for you? Did you just see an opportunity and you're like, I'm going to be the solution to this problem? Or how did you get into that?
Well, when I first got out, I went and took all the tests and everything for the post office. Another federal job. After I took tests, all I had to do was walk in and say, here, I'm ready to go to work. And I told my wife, I said, I spent 20 years tramping around through the mud and snow. I don't want to do it anymore. So I saw an advertisement in the paper for a realtor. So I went down, talked to the broker, said, okay. So I went and got my license. So for the next 26 years, I tramped around in the mud and snow. And then make pot for money. Mm-hmm. Not in this county.
I just love that you had said that you were specializing in helping veterans with homes.
Yeah, that was just the thing I wanted to do. When I got into the real estate business and I saw they had VA loans, that's what I started really studying and specializing in.
Mm-hmm.
And even on my business card, it said veterans helping veterans.
I love that.
Just my niche that I did.
I feel like the veteran community is one of the uniquest because it never stops.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I had gone to Honor Flight, I was standing next to a veteran from Vietnam who was in the Purple Heart Association.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing him sincerely thank another veteran who was walking down being welcomed home, like,
yeah.
it was an instant connection, almost like a sense of comfort mm-hmm. when they both had that recognition of this person understands.
Yeah, yeah. Going up, mm-hmm. going to different festivals and everything like that, and we'll have our veterans hats on. Mm-hmm. I was like, "How you doing, brother? What'd you serve in?" And that kind of stuff. It's just, we're a brotherhood. We're all brothers and sisters. Like, one girl over to the post office. Mm-hmm. She was in the Army. And every so often I'll go in there and I'll say, "Hey, sister, how you doing?" And it's just, we're all one family. With, no matter what. We might call Marines jarheads. The Air Force flyboys, the Coast Guard's coasties, the Navy's squids. We might harass everybody. We're, as a tanker, as a dumbass tanker, or grunts for everybody else. We harass each other, mm-hmm. but it's all fun and games, and we know it, and we're just one big happy family.
I love that. When you had got connected to other veterans, especially within Coshocton County, was the Honor Guard something that you knew about, or was it something that you had gotten connected to through other veterans?
Both. Mm-hmm. I knew about them, but I didn't know how to get into it. And I saw them at funerals, and I started asking questions, and they said they'd be glad to have me. So I joined, and that's been 12, 15 years ago now.
That's amazing. I remember being like 11, and when we had opened the funeral home, and Dad would have to literally pull me out of the, like, your guys' lines when you're trying to be at attention before marching in. And I wanted to say hello and like say thank you. And it was just always my thing. And I remember Dad literally had to yank me out of the line. And for anyone listening, my family owns a funeral home. But I've always looked up to all of you guys because I think it's so beautiful that you've already put in so much service to our country, but the service between each other never stops.
No.
And giving that final honor, the most high honor you can give, and then the 21 gun salute is,
yeah.
There is nothing more special than that moment.
Yeah. Right now, we have such short people. Mm-hmm. We're a shortage of people that, like yesterday, it was the 3-gun salute. Because we don't have enough people to have a 7 riflemen mm-hmm. and then have the other members that we need for holding flags and doing the service and that kind of stuff. So we do what we can, the best mm-hmm. we can.
Definitely. I mean, just even the gesture of having that. And I assume even within the color guard, it's the same thing. It's just the absolute presence of having veterans there. It just makes all the difference.
Yeah.
I know you mentioned before of getting connected to other veterans just made everything easier. So what would your advice be to a young veteran who may just be getting out of the service?
Let's check in with the veteran service office, wherever you're located at. Mm-hmm. Talk to them. A lot of negativity is towards the American Legion and the VFW because that's the old regime, but still get involved with them. Definitely get involved with your local veterans clinic. They can help you out tons. There's a lot of negativity about the veterans offices, veterans hospitals and clinics and stuff like that. I've been going to them since 94. I've never had any negativity, any problems. I've got great doctors, great nurses. Mm-hmm. I don't know where I'd be without them. Just get involved as much as you can. Join an honor guard, join a color guard.
I appreciate you sharing all of that and being as honest as possible, because I remember even when I started to get into this, to helping veterans, I went to the places I knew where veterans were, and that was the AMVETs and the VFWs and the Legions mm-hmm. and the DAV. And what I thought was interesting is they all were, one, shocked that someone so young knew that they existed, but when I had went in and I asked how I could help them, it was to get the word out. Mm-hmm. Because I had someone even tell me, he's the commander of the one in Delaware, Ohio. He was like, people think we're a bar, but yeah, that's one part of the building, but it's the people who make it there, and it's right. the fellowship, and it's getting connected to each other. And I appreciate you bringing those resources up, because I mean, they want the younger vets to come in because they can help them beat the learning curve.
Right.
You know, like, you've already walked the path, so why do they need to start a new one when you can guide them through it? Mm-hmm. You know? Well, thank you so much for bringing up those resources and the advice. I hope anyone who listens to this after the fact is able to take some of that to heart. But well, as we wrap up here, Tom, thank you so much for being my first guest on this. I've had a blast even diving in. I know I have a few pages of your testimony in front of me, but it's been a blast to ask questions and to talk about it. And thank you for talking about it. I know it not only means the world to me, but the impact that you're leaving through this is...
Well, I appreciate your interest in it and doing this.
And thank you so much, obviously, from the bottom of my heart for your service. I know you've been such a big part of our family's funeral home and with the Honor Guard, and especially during the service of my grandpa, and your service as well abroad. But thank you so much for your continued service.
You're welcome.
And that's a wrap for our very first episode of the Veteran Narrative Podcast. I hope you enjoyed everything that Tom shared with his military testimony and his advice from life. The Veteran Narrative Podcast is an extended program of the nonprofit organization, The Veteran Narrative. To find out more about The Veteran Narrative's mission and other programs, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at The Veteran Narrative. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.